All right, we're beginning on the bottom of Kuf Lamed Zayin Amud Bet, 5 lines up. Ki Atav Rav Dimi, Amar Reshita Geiz, Rav Amar Bishishim, Rav Yochanan Mishum Ravinai, Amar Bishesh. So here we had a machloket throughout this daf as to what the sheet of the Chachamim is with regards to Bekol Shehein. That's one part of it. The second part is, then what percentage would you give out of that number? The Gemara has come to the conclusion that you wouldn't give less than a selah, even though our Mishnah seems to indicate that you have to give 5 sla'im. There the Gemara said that that was not necessarily connected to the amount that you were giving, but rather if you were going to give to multiple kohanim, what's the minimum amount you have to give to each kohen? But at this point, the assumption is that you wouldn't give less than a selah, and you have now the position of Rav, and over here you're saying that Rav says it's b'shishim. Yet before, when we brought Rav Dosa ben Hurkina Somer, in the beginning of the Gemara, we said, Kama Koshein Amarav Mana Upras. It was 150 dinarim. Now we're saying that it's Shishim in Sela. Now each Sela is worth 4 dinarim. That would say that the total is 240 dinarim. Mana Upras is 150 dinarim, which is 37.5 slaim, which is, again, 150 divided by 4. So how do you reconcile those? Rav Yochanan Mishum Rav Yanai Omer Vishesh. And now you have Rabbi Yochanan in the name of Rabbi Yanai saying B'sheish. Yet Rabbi Yochanan had said right before to Isi Barhini, when Isi Barhini said to him, Reshita Geiz B'kamo. So then Rabbi Yochanan said to him, B'shishim, that it was 60 that required it. Now over here it says Rabbi Yochanan Mishun Rabbi Yanai Amar B'sheish, which matches what he said above also, where Rabbi Barchan in the name of Rabbi Yochanan said Sheish. Amar Le Yabai Rav Dimi, Anchad Lan Chada, V'akshat Lan Chada. You solved one problem. And you brought up one question. Bishlama the Rabbi Yochanan to Rabbi Yochanan Lokasho. So how do I reconcile between the Sheish and the Shishim? That I can reconcile because Hadidei Hadirabei. He himself believed that it was Shishim, but he quoted in the name of his Rebbe, Rabbi Yanai, that it was Sheish. And now I understand that that Sheish and the Shishim over here can be reconciled because one of them is his opinion, one of them is the opinion of his Rebbe. Ela Darava Darav Kasho. What do you do with the two positions of Rav? Dama Rav, Mane Upras. For Rav, I don't have that. Now I have a problem, because Rav said Mane Upras up above when we brought the Shior, and now you're bringing a Shior of 60 Sela for Rav. So how do I reconcile that? And the problem with Rav is twofold. If you believe that he's saying 60 Sela over here, that doesn't match up with what he said before Mane Upras, which is 37.5 Slaim. Or if you think that Shishim here means 1/60th, then 1/60th of the Mane Upras he said before is 1/60th of 37.5. You don't get to that minimum threshold of 1 selah. And as Rashi says, nobody thinks that less than a selah is large enough for Reshita Geiz. And if that's the case, how do I reconcile Rav's position over here of saying 1/60th and 37.5 slaim? Or how do I reconcile 60 selah with 37.5 slaim that he mentioned before? They're both the same question, which is that 1/60th is the number, and we need a minimum of selah, which means you need 60 selah, and Rav Abab was saying 37.5 slaim. Mar says, Lokasha, my mane de kamar bin arba'im slaim. This mane is a different size mane, which is that mane usually means 100 and 100 dinarim. If a selah is 4 dinarim, that means that a mane would have 25 selah in it. But there are certain manot that have 40 slaim in them. Dabilei bishishim. If you do that, then 60 is the right number. If each mane has got 40 selah in it, then mane and a half, Mane Upras, would equal 60 Sela. And that's the number that we're speaking about here. Tani Tano, Mane Ben Arbaim Slaim. Is there such a concept? Is there such a Tanaic position that there is a Mane that has 40 Sela in it? Mar says in, there is. Atanan, we have a Mishnah, Benichuta, Chemet, a water skin. This is a canteen that's made out of leather. Chadasha, if it's brand new, Afabish Mikabelet Ribonim, even though it's the size of the hole in it, would allow you to store pomegranates in it, tehora. It remains tehora because there was never what's called gemar melocha. It was never converted into a kli. Since it never became a kli, it's not mekabel tuma. Once it's made into a kli, then in order to unwind or undo the shame kli, there it has to have a hole in it that's big enough to allow rimonim out of it. Because once it's been purposed as a kli, then repurposing it for other usages is fine and keeps it as a kli. But if you never got to the point of a kli, then it won't be mekabel tuma. So in this instance, where they didn't finish stitching it up, and there's still a hole in it, even though it can hold rimonim, that's not the purpose. The original purpose is a canteen, it's for liquids, it's got to be sealed completely. So you never reach the point of Gemara Kli, it's not going to have Kabbalat Tumah. Tafra, on the other hand, if you stitched it and it was fully sealed and it was good for liquids, then Nikra'a, and then it tore, then Shi'ura Kemotzei Rimonim. Like any other Kli, Balabayit, then it has to have a hole the size of storing pomegranates in it in order for it to be Ois Kli now. Until that point, the Mishnah goes through all different sizes. Size of a pebble, size of an olive, size of this, size of that. Each hole getting successively bigger, you can repurpose the kli. Until the final repurposing, which is rimonim, which are pomegranates are extremely large. It has a hole in it the size of a pomegranate, it's no longer useful at all, and it loses its same kli. Rabbi Eliezer ben Yaakov Omer, Pipakiyot Shosheti, Achat Me'arba B'maneh Ben Arba'im Slaim. Rabbi Eliezer ben Yaakov gives the disqualifying feature for it to lose its shame kli as not being motzi rimonim, but rather the balls of the sheti, which is the thread that is used on the loom. The ones that are on the loom itself to make the warp, the erev is the ones that you shoot through, that you pull back and forth, that you use with the shuttle and going back and forth. The ones that are on the loom itself are the sheti. So it's the balls of the sheti that were seemingly a standard size. And that ball of sheti, which is achat mi'arba b'maneh, it's one out of four in a maneh, ben arba'im slaim, when a maneh has 40 sela in it. So it's giving you a maneh that is valued or has translated at 40 sela per maneh. So that's number one. And number two, it's achat mi'arba, one out of four of a maneh, but when the maneh has 40 slaim in it, which means that it's 10 slaim. And not what you would have done on a standard basis, which would have been that if it was a maneh, you would have 25 sela in it, and then 1/4 of that would be 6 1/4 sela. So here we're talking about a much bigger maneh that contains within it 40 sela, and that's the basis of Rav's statement that we have that says that it's 60 sela, is also maneh pras, when the maneh contains within it 40 sela. Always you have to ask the question, which is the static coin in your currency? And which one is the moving one? It might be that a maneh is 100 dinar no matter what, and then 40 sela just means that this la'im were smaller. Or it could be that it's a maneh here would be bigger. It's 40 sela, which means the maneh is really 160 dinarim. But it seems in all likelihood that the maneh is the thing that is static, the 100 dinarim, and therefore the sela here you're speaking about is 40 sela to the maneh, which is 60 sela when you do a maneh pras, but it still will always equal 150 dinarim, which was the maneh pras that Rav was speaking about. Now we move on to the next piece. V'kama notein lo, how much does he give to him? So Tana, lo shio banenu, not that you actually bleach it, v'nenu lo, and then give it to the Kohen, ela shio banenu, Kohen, v'amod al chamech slaim. The Mishnah says that you have to give 5 sela in Yehuda of bleached wool or clean wool. So the Mishnah seems to indicate that you're not supposed to bleach it, because later on in the Mishnah it says, if you bleach it, you still have to give it. If you dye it, then you don't have to give it anymore. So what is it that when you bleach it, the Mishnah has to tell you that you still give it? If that's what you have to do, then of course you give it. From there, it seems like the proper way to give it to the Kohen is when it's soy, when it's still dirty, when it's still fresh, that you give the wool to him. So then why is the Mishnah telling you that the weight or the size of what you have to give to him is 5 sela in Yehuda of white bleached wool? The answer is that you have to give him enough that once it's bleached and cleaned, it equals 5 sela in Yehuda. So that's the end product that it needs to get to. So you have to give him enough tzoi so that it reaches that point, but not that you yourself have to actually bleach it. Kedei lasod beged katan, the amount of white wool or bleached wool, which is the 5 sela, the reason you're giving them, that is so that it reaches an itina that's significant, which is the fact that it can make a beged katan. Mina hanei mile, where do we know this from? Amri b'shuban levi, amar krah. If you look in the Psukim by the Reshit HaGeiz, the subsequent Pasuk in Reshit HaGeiz is Reshit HaGanchat Tirosh Chavit Zarecha Reshit Geiz Son HaChati Deino. The next Pasuk is Kivo Bachar Hashem Lokecha Mikosh Vatecha Le'amod L'Sharet B'Shem Hashem Hu Banav Kol Hayamim. So right afterwards, juxtaposed to that Pasuk is speaking about the Kohanim, but not only about the Kohanim, the fact that the Kohanim are L'amod L'Sharet, that they go and serve in the Mikdash, which is the reason why the matnot kunar given to the Kohanim is because they don't have a means of parnasa. they have given up their lives to Hekdesh, in a sense. They work for the Mikdash. They serve on behalf of Bnei Yisrael and the Mikdash. And so then Bnei Yisrael pays them, in a sense, a wage for doing such. That wage is the Truma, the Reshida Geiz, the Zerah L'Chayayim V'Keiva, and so on and so forth. All the Matnot Kuhuna, which are because Lamod V'Lesharet. Now, one of the reasons given by the Rishonim for why Reshita Geiz is given to the Kohen is because the Kohen gets all different items to help him sustain himself. He gets food, but he also needs clothing. And so Reshita Geiz provides the clothing aspect of it. In that context, it says the reason that Hashem has given them this is because he has chosen them, Lamod L'Sharet. So the juxtaposition of Lamod L'Sharet, Davar Shu Ra'oi L'Sherut, it has to be you have given him enough wool that he can make something that he can serve in the Mikdash with. My Nehu. So what is the smallest of the big day kuhuna? Is the avnei, is the belt that he wears. The Gemara says, Ema Me'il. Why does it have to be the belt? What about the Me'il, which is made out of Kulo Techelet? It's all wool, and that would be a much larger size that you would then be obligated to give him. My answer is, Tafasta Miruba, Lo Tafasta. Tafasta Muat, Tafasta. The principle that Rashi over here explains that comes out of the Braita and Torah Kohanim, which is that if you have a choice in interpretation, you can interpret something to have a much larger number, or you can interpret something to have a much smaller number. Whenever you pick the larger number, you can always ask me the question, why don't you take the smaller number if you take the larger number? On the other hand, if you do the opposite and you pick the smaller number, you can ask me why you didn't pick the bigger number, but I will tell you the reason I picked the smaller number is it fulfills whatever is written in the Pasuk, and therefore why should I have to do any more than what the Pasuk says? This number satisfies that, and this is the minimum that satisfies that. Given that, it makes more sense to say the Mu'at rather than the Mruba, or the way to say it, Rashi expressions in other places in Shas, is that if you take the larger number, then you don't necessarily cover the smaller number. If you have the smaller number is always subsumed in the larger number. So the smaller number, when you take it, you get the Mu'at, but you also get the Meruba would have included the smaller number as well. If you take the Meruba, then you've only got the big number, you don't have the smaller number that is subsumed within it. Ve'ema kippa shel tzemer. Why don't we use the kippa shel tzemer, which is even a smaller baguette? Titania, kippa shel tzemer, hayta munechet v'rosh kohen gadol. There was this kippa made out of tzemer that was on the head of the kohen gadol. Baleh tzitz natun. And the tzitz was sitting on top of it, the kayem ha-shenemar, v'samto to al p'til techelet. In order that the tzitz be sitting on top of a p'til techelet. Now, what exactly this kippa shel tzemer is not clear. In addition, it's somewhat problematic. It's not mentioned amongst the eight big day kuhuna, so then how does he put on what's called a yitur beged, an extra beged? That's number one. Number two is, where did this ever come from, that you have this kippah shel tzemer that the kohen gadol has to wear? And then in what context is it that we say that he has to wear a kippah shel tzemer? So Rashi says that the kiyum of this pasuk, if you look in Rashi and Chumash, Samto Tov Ptil Tchelet is a reference to the tzitz itself, and the tzitz itself has these Ptil Tchelet that hold it on the head of the Kohen Gadol. It's a band that goes on his forehead. If he doesn't have things to tie it onto his head, it's going to fall off, it's going to slip off. For that reason, there is a hole on the right and left side of this band, and they have Ptil Tchelet, which are strings of wool dyed Tchelet, that go into each hole on each side and tie to the back of his head. But then, if you do that, it's still going to fall off because there's nothing holding it on top. So then there's a hole in the middle at the top that also has a p'til t'chelet that goes over the top of his head. Two strings go over the top of his head, and they tie in the back. All the strings, all six strings meet in the back, and you knot them in the back, the p'til t'chelet. So Rashi says, the kaim et p'sukim, about whether the tzitz is on the p'til t'chelet is on the tzitz, is based on those holes. Those holes allow it that the tzitz has a p'til t'chelet that goes through it, and then after the hole, it's underneath the tzitz. And the other side of the hole, it's above the tzitz. That's one issue. And then you have the same thing with regards to the mitznefet, which is that the p'til t'chelet runs over the top of the mitznefet. So according to Rashi, the p'til t'chelet that we're speaking about here, and the kippah shel tzemer is just simply that string of t'chelet. It's not really a kippah. It's just something that goes over his head that holds the tzitz in place. On the other hand, others say that that's not what's said here. Over here it says kippah shel tzemer. It's not just a like a kippah, it really is a kippah shel tzemer. And there was a necessity for the kippah shel tzemer to be mikayim the pasuk of sam to'oto p'til t'chelet. You got to put it on something that is dyed blue wool, or t'chelet wool, and therefore there was a little kippah that he wore that the tzitz sat on top of to be mikayim this pasuk. And even though that's not mentioned in the big day kuhuna, and even though it seems like it'll be a katzitza between the tzitz and the kohen gadol, pasuk tells you sam to'oto p'til t'chelet. So we view it as an extension of the tzitz. We don't see this as being a separate beged. We see this as being part and parcel of the tzitz itself. And therefore, it's permitted because it's necessary. And number two is it's not a separate beged. It is the tzitz. The tzitz requires this tzitz t'chelet. And this was this small, whatever, kippah made out of wool dyed t'chelet that sat on the kohen's head in order to mikayim this pasuk. The third explanation that's brought is the possibility that this was only true when the Kohen Gadol was not wearing his Shmona Begadim. Kohen Gadol had to wear the tzitz all the time, at least according to one opinion as to what the word tamid means. And according to those that say tamid, he always has to wear it. So Baal Tosafot has a view that even when he's not wearing his Shmona Begadim, he still wears the tzitz. In that case, if he's wearing the tzitz without the Shmona Begadim, he wears this kippah shel tzemer as part of the tzitz, in order to have it al p'til t'chelet, because he's not wearing his mitznefet, because he's missing some of the features that he would have if he's wearing the Shmona Begadim. So they suggest maybe that this was a fulfillment of the sam to'oto al p'til t'chelet in the case where he's not wearing his Shmona Begadim. Those are the three different ways to explain it. No matter which way you explain it, you have something that's smaller than an avnit. And if you're going to say that we want to take the smallest beged possible, then this would have qualified as being the smallest item that is ra'oi for a kohen to go to be shmisharet with, or for a kohen to wear as part of his big day kuhuna. And this should have been sufficient to then be given to the kohen as a nitina. Mar says, you can't say that because Amar Gra hu ubanav. The pasuk doesn't just say the kohen gadol, it says that the amod sharet b'shem Hashem hu ubanav kol hayamim. He, meaning the kohen gadol, ubanav and his children who are the kohanim hedjotot. So if that's the case, then the kippah shel tzemer is a unique beged that's associated with the kohen gadol, not something that is also included with the kohen hedjot. So therefore, the kippah is out now, and it's got to be the avnet. The avnet is something that's shared in common between the kohen hedjot and the kohen gadol. Where it says avnet nami lo shavi. Who says that the avnet is also equal? Hanicha leman d'amar avneto shel kohen gadol lo zehu avneto shel kohen hedjot shapir. That the avnate of the Kohen Gadol is not the avnate of the Kohen Hedjot, then it works out well. Ella, the man d'amar, zehu avnato shel Kohen Hedjot, that's the same as the Kohen Hedjot, ma'ika the meimar. What are you going to do about it? This has to do with a machloket as to regards to the avnate of the Kohen Hedjot. The Kohen Gadol, it's clear that his avnate, his belt, during the rest of the year, was made out of kilayim. It was made out of the four different materials that were used in the big day kuhuna, three of which were wool, one of which was pishtan. You have tchelet, argaman, and tulat shani, which are all wool that are dyed in those colors. And then you have the sheish, which is the linen. And they were made out of those four materials, woven together six ply each. So the avnet of the Kohen Gadol definitely had kilayim in it. On Yom HaKippurim, it's also clear that the avnet of the Kohen Gadol did not have kilayim in it, because the pasuk says in Parshat Achrimot, that when he goes to do this, he has to wear all big day boots. It's all bad, which is linen. And everything that he wore on Yom HaKippurim was white linen. That was the big day kuhuna of Yom HaKippurim. So the avnet of Yom Kippur for the Kohen Gadol was not kilayim. It was just an avnet made out of sheish, made out of linen. So now the question is, what is the avnet of the Kohen Hedjot made out of? Because the avnet of the Kohen Gadol during the rest of the year is kilayim. The avnet of the Kohen Gadol in Yom HaKippurim is sheish. So the question is the avnet of the Kohen Hedjot parallel to the one of the Kohen Gadol in Yom Kippur? Because the rest of the year, the Kohen Hedjot wears the four big adim, which the Kohen Gadol wears on Yom Kippur. And therefore the belt would be equated, and that means he would wear a belt made out of sheish. Or is it that the Kohen Hedjot has the same avnet as the Kohen Gadol during the rest of the year? And therefore their belt is kilayim the rest of the year. That's what the Gemara says here. Hanicha, it works well according to the one who says that the Avnei of the Kohen Gadol Yom Kippur is not the Avnei of the Kohen Hejot during the rest of the year. Because that means that the Kohen Hejot had the same belt as the Kohen Gadol. They were both made out of kilayim the rest of the year. And that means now you have something that is equal, both by Kohen Gadol and Kohen Hejot, and includes wool in it. And that would be the minimum gift that you would have to give to the Kohen. But according to the one who says that the Avnate, the belt of the Kohen Gadol on Yom Kippur, is the belt of the Kohen Hejot the rest of the year, then you don't have it. There's no wool in the Avnate of the Kohen Hejot the rest of the year. If that's the case, then you don't have something that's equal to the Kohen Gadol and the Kohen Hejot. The Kohen Hejot only wears linen in his belt. And therefore, how could the Avnate be the representative beged, that is the tafasta mu'at, that you were going to use? The answer of the Gemara is, shame Avnate ba'olam. It's different than the kippah shel tzemer. By the kippah shel tzemer, it is something that is only worn by the Kohen Gadol and has no manifestation by the Kohen Gadol whatsoever. The Avnate, even though if you believe that the Avnate of the Kohen Gadol was made out of linen and there's no wool in it, but it's still a manifestation of an Avnate in a Kohen Gadol. And therefore we can say, or we can equate the belt of the Kohen Gadol with the belt of the Kohen Hejot, and say that common denominator between them is what gives you the din of the minimum size of tzemer. Even though the Kohen Hejot himself doesn't have tzemer in it, nevertheless, it's something that's a shared beged, maybe not in the way it's made, but it's a shared beged between the Kohen Hejot and Kohen Gadol, and that's enough. Now, it might be now, based on the conclusion of the Gemara, that we're not using the principle of tefasta meruba or tefasta muat. What we're using as the principle now is it has to be a shared beged between the Kohen Gadol and the Kohen Hejot. The only shared beged between them that has tzemer in it is the Avnit. Meaning that the Me'il, which you suggested before, is a unique beged to the Kohen Gadol. It's not even an option at this point. The only option that you have is the Avnit, and therefore the determining factor is no longer tafas de merubah or tafas de muat. The determining factor is find me a beged that is shared in common between the Kohen Gadol and Kohen Hejot that has wool in it. And the only thing that you have is the Avnate. And that's why that is the minimum size that you have to give to the Kohen in order for it to be a Netina with regards to Reshita Geiz. Lo hispik ledono, if he didn't give it to him before he converted it into either bleaching it or dyeing it into a different color. Itmar, gazaz umachar rishona. What happens if he shears the animal and then sells it off? Rav Chisda amar chayav. Bechista says, even though you're selling it off one at a time, and then after you get to five, it would have meant the minimum threshold if you got to number five, but you sold it before you got to number five. So each one along the way, you're selling it before you reach the quantity that makes you chayav. Bechista says you're chayav anyway. Binatan Boshaya Amar Patur. Binatan Boshaya says you never meet the minimum threshold, so you're not chayav. Bechista Amar Chayav Da Gazaz. You did the shearing, and this is Reshit HaGeiz. So you did the giza
when it was your tzon. The fact that you don't own the tzon anymore is not relevant.
The fact that you sold it off beforehand is not meaningful because the requirement is that what you shear, you give from. When you reach the final threshold, it has to be your tzon. And that's not the case over here. It's the reshit geiz tzon. By the time you get to the minimum threshold, it's no longer your tzon. You've already sold it off. It's none. Our Mishnah, lokeach geiz tzono shel oved kochavim, patur mireshita geiz. Someone who purchases the shearings of an oved kochavim, he is patur mireshita geiz. Now this is, according to Rashi, it's a case where the sheep still have the shearings on them, and you're buying the shearings from the oved kochavim. When you shear the animal then, you still don't have to give reshita geiz, even though you own the shearings, and you own the shearings while they're on the sheep. You don't have to give it as Reshita Geiz because, the Gemara said earlier, it's not Tzon Cha. It's not your Tzon. It's still the Goy's Tzon. It just happens to be that you own the shearings that come off of that Tzon. So that's not enough to qualify you to be Chayav because it's not Reshita Geiz Tzon Cha. Huh? But from this it would sound like Tzonot Igzoz Chayav. According to this, if you bought the actual sheep with the shearings on them, so now that you own the sheep and you sheared the sheep, you would be chayav. The Gemara says, "Amai kochai v'chad butter giza napka lemirshute." Each one of them, after you shear them, goes back to the goy. So the difference in the transaction is that the first transaction was you simply bought the shearings and then you sheared them and took the shearings for yourself. The second transaction is that you bought the sheep to shear it, which means that after you finish shearing it, it goes back to the owner. It's a semantic issue, but has a big difference in what's happening here. Meaning that in both cases, all you're buying is the shearing. The question is, how are you buying the shearing? In a sense, are you borrowing the sheep and shearing them for your shearings? Or are you buying the sheep temporarily so that they're yours while you do the shearing? So in that case, the Mishnah or the Diyuk of the Mishnah would be that you are Chayav. So there it seems that when it's Son Cha, even though the Son revert back to the owner before you finish, you're going to still give Reshita gains from it. So that shows you, like Rav Chista, that every time you shear it, even though you've sold it off or given it away, by the time you get to the threshold, you're still Chayav. So by the time you get to the threshold, it's not Son Cha anymore. It's all given back to the guy. So Gemara says, Targama Rav Chista libet Rabbi Natan Vahoshaya. I always love these lines in the Gemara, because here is a machlok between Rav Chista and Rabbi Natan Bar Hoshaya. And now Rav Chista comes to the defense of his Bar Plukta, Rav Natan Bar Hoshaya. Meaning that they're after the truth, not about whether they're right or not. And therefore he's willing, even though the Mishnah is more supportive of him, to come to the defense of Rabbi Natan Bar Hoshaya. Kagon, Shehikna Lo Koshloshim Yom. It was a case where they were temporarily given to you, not in the way that once you shear them, they revert back. But rather, he gives them to you until you're finished. So it doesn't have to literally be 30 days. It just has to be that it's not that automatically when you finish shearing, it reverts back to the goy. It's the fact that once you finish all of them and you're done, that's when it all goes back. So in that case, you do own it at the time that you hit the threshold, and therefore would not be a question on Rabbi Natan Bar Hoshaya. Someone who purchases the shearings of his friend. Matana. Who is the Tana that says, that if you leave something by the Mocher is the one that is responsible. You remember in our Mishnah, we said that if you buy the shearings off of the Jew, then if you buy everything that he owns, then you have to give the Matnot Kuna, your Chayav and Reshita Geis. If you buy, but leave some residual with the Mocher, the assumption is that the Reshita Geis is with the Mocher, and the Lokeach then is exempt from any Reshita Geis, because the Reshita Geis is going to be given by the Mocher. So now, who is the Tano that has this view that when you leave something by the Mocher is the responsible party? So Rav Chista, Rabbi Yehuda, it's got to be Rabbi Yehuda, Ditnan, and Peya, a Mocher Kilchei Ilan. Someone who sells stalks of a tree. Kilchei is clearly the wrong term to use by a tree. A Kelach is something that is used by vegetables. So for that reason, the Rishonim over here come up with different explanations as to what is going on over here. The Rambam in the Parish of Mishnayot takes it very literally and says it's not a tree, it's kilcheilan, it's really vegetables that have kalachim, that have stalks in them. Rashi over here explains that the kilcheilan is because it's actually a vegetable field or a grain field that have individual trees that are dispersed amongst the vegetables or the grains that are in this field, and that's why they're called Kilchei Ilan, because they are onesie-twosies. It's not a state Ilan. This is not an orchard. This is rather a grain field, or it is a vegetable patch, and you have trees in it. So in order to indicate that, they're calling the trees like vegetables, and saying that they're Kilchei Ilan, so they're individual trees. Because otherwise, if it's a state Ilan, it would have a different din. So now over here, B'toksadeu, Notein Peya, L'kol Echad Ve'Echad. He has to give Peah for each one of them. Amar Yehuda, Eimatai. When is that true? Bizman Shlo Shier Bala Sadeh. That's if the owner of the field didn't leave something behind. Aba Shier Bala Sadeh, Noten Peah Ala Kol. If the Bala Sadeh left something behind, then he gives Peah on everything. So Rashi explains over here that the case here is where he purchased the trees. The individual came and bought the trees, or the seller sold these trees that are in the middle of this field. Now, each one of them now has to give payout separately, because you can't aggregate them. Because the owner over here owns individual trees that are dispersed in this field. It's not a stay ilan. Had it been a stay ilan, then you give payout from the entire field. Over here, where there's no entire field of trees, you have to give payout from each tree separately. So that's the first din. The second din is that it's the lokeach's responsibility, which is that the payout is given to him because it says by the trees, lo tefayer acharecha. That you can't wipe them out completely. You have to leave something over. You have to leave the pe'er of the tree behind. If it was his own field, then he'd be able to give pe'ah on everything that's there. Rabbi Yehuda comes along and says, that's only true if the Bala Sadeh didn't leave any trees for himself. But the Bala Sadeh left a tree for himself, then all the Chiyuv Peyah devolves upon that tree that's there, because he'll give Peyah to the Karka Bizraim Lanim, that he gives, whether it's off that tree in particular, or it's off the field in general, he can give Peyah to the Aniim, because for him, the field has a classification of a field, and so therefore he can pay off the entire field, and even that tree would be subsumed in his field, because he's the owner of the field. The other party only owns individual trees, he doesn't own the field, so he has to give it separately. But here, Rav Yehuda says, if the owner leaves behind himself a tree, that tree that leaves behind then will carry along everything with it, including the trees that were sold, they'll be covered by this one tree. So what you have here is clearly that Rav Yehuda says that if you leave a residual, the owner leaves something residual to himself, he assumes all the responsibility of the matanot that are required over here. So here, where he leaves one tree for himself, he assumes the responsibility of all the trees of the field, plus the Izraim of the field, and he'll take care of the peyah. So the person who purchased them is no longer chayav and peyah for the trees that he took. On the other hand, if he sold them all the trees, then he doesn't have any responsibility for it, or he's not retaining responsibility because he kept the Zeraim, he sold you the trees. He doesn't have any tree that's subsumed in his payah, and therefore the payah is responsibility of the buyer of the trees, and he's got to give for each tree individually. But the problem is, Amar Le Rava, Vavhar Marhu De Amar. Rava says to Rav Chista, didn't you qualify this Mishnah? To who Shehit Kil Balasadeh Liktzor? That's only if the owner of the field began to harvest. Because the chiyuv peyah devolves when you start to harvest. As soon as you begin to harvest, the obligation of peyah exists. Once the obligation of peyah exists, then you can say that the mocher took responsibility and he's going to give the peyah for the entirety of the field. And when he sold it X the peyah, that is the responsibility of the seller. On the other hand, if he didn't harvest yet, there's no chiyuv peyah yet. Then he can't say that the payah that the mocher is going to give is going to cover the koneh. They have nothing to do with each other. There's an obligation on the trees. There's an obligation on the field. One person can't give payah for the other person. Each one who's harvesting is responsible for their payah. So when the mocher can take care of the okeach's trees, is only when he became chayav in the payah before he sold it. But if he didn't become chayav in the payah before he sold it, then he can't be responsible for the okeach's payah. They're separate entities. They're separate ownership. He can't give payah for someone else. So Umar says, if you want to say the same thing here by Reshita Geiz, then in our Mishnah when it says that the Mocher is responsible for, it's only Mi'u Sheit Chil Digzoz, that's only if he began to shear already. Bishlam Ha'otam, over there by payah it says, Ubikutz Rechem Met Ketzir Atzechem, that when you begin to harvest your fields, Ketiv Mi'idna Da'at Chil Digzor Mechayev Bekula Sadeh. It says there that once you start to harvest, then you become chayav on payah for the entire field. Just because you begin to shear, doesn't mean you're chayav in your entire flock. Each shearing is what makes you chayav. If you start shearing, it doesn't mean now you have to give Reshita Geiz from the entire flock because you started shearing this one. You give Reshita Geiz once you've sheared. By the payah, it says, Bekutz Rechem, it could see Artzechem, Bekutz Rechem. But over here, it doesn't say, Gozeschem, Ela Geiz Tzoncha, Titeino. Which makes it sound like only after the Geiz begins, is there a Chiyuv. And that's part of what we said earlier, that when you shear the animal, that's what generates the, quote-unquote, Kedushat HaGeiz, because it doesn't have a din of tevel while it's still on the animal, because it's only geiz tzoncha once it's already sheared that it becomes kadosh, not when it's still on the animal. As opposed to kutz rechem, which means that as you begin to do the katsir, that already obligates the individual vis-a-vis the entirety of the field. As we said before, they only give the payah at the end. That's for technical reasons, so that people don't cheat, the aniyim know when to come. Those are technical reasons, but the payah, or the chiyuv payah, devolves immediately as soon as you begin to harvest. And that's for the entirety of the field. So in that sense, you can have the mocher be responsible for the payah here as soon as he begins to harvest. The mocher, if he starts to shear, it doesn't have any impact on the remainder of the animals that have not been sheared yet, and therefore if he sold them, it can't be that he's already obligated. If that's the case, Rabbi Yehuda cannot be the author of our Mishnah. Elo Merova, hai Tanahu. It's this Tana that's the author of our Mishnah. It's not the Mishnah from the previous parak. Amar lo, mechor li b'nei me'eha. sell me the innards or the intestines, shel parazo, of this cow, v'yaben matanot. And in there, where the matanot, the keba was in there, notan the kohen, the buyer has to give it to the kohen, v'ein menachalo min adamim. And he doesn't deduct the money from it because he knows when he buys the intestines, the keba is not coming with it, and he paid money for whatever it was, ex the keba, because he knows the keba belongs to the kohen. So whether the mocher took it out already, or whether the lokeach gets it and he has to get it to the kohen, that shouldn't have changed his pricing and shouldn't have changed his assumptions about what he is getting. On the other hand, lakach mimenu b'mishkal, if you bought it from him on a weight basis, notan the kohen, he still has to give it to the kohen, the buyer, because it's not his, it belongs to the kohen. On the other hand, menachalo min adumim, he does get to deduct that from the price. He can go back to the mocher and say, take that off the price. Because when I buy by weight, I assume you're selling me only things that I can utilize in that weight. I don't expect you to put the matnat kuna and charge me for the weight of the keba and then have me give it away to the kohen. When I buy by weight, I'm buying exactly what I can use and utilize. That is the din that we saw in those mishnayot previously. Rava says that tana is the tana that says shiur has impact. Almo. So what you see from this is matnot kohen lo mizamin inish. People do not sell the matnot kuna. That's the way Rashi reads it. On the other hand, Tosafot seems to read it, you do not buy it. And that is because it depends which half of the Mishnah you are midayek out of. Rashi is midayek out of the second half of the Mishnah, because as Rashi says over here, taimo de matnitin, the reason in the Mishnah is mishum de'en adam rashai lefkia memono miyad mitzvah. Person can't take his money and strip it of a mitzvah. If you have a monetary obligation that's coming out of your possessions, a person can't sell away that mitzvah. Or a person doesn't sell away that mitzvah. So for that reason, in the second half of the Mishnah, when it says that you did it by weight, we assume that he didn't sell him the matnot kuna in the weight, because it was his obligation to give the matanat kuna, and he wouldn't have sold that off to lose the mitzvah, get paid for it, and then have someone else give it. He would have maintained the mitzvah for himself. And similarly, by Reshita Gaze, as long as he has gaze that's left, he's going to maintain responsibility for it because he's not going to sell away the mitzvah that is associated with his monetary possessions. So that's the driving force over here. In the case where he sold the keba, you can't argue that he didn't give him the keba. The keba's there and it's gone. He gave it away. The assumption is that what he charged him for was all the items besides the keba, and therefore he's not selling the keba to him, he's not monetizing it, the keba goes to the kohen. In the case where he sold it by weight, you can't say that anymore. Because by weight, and he weighed the keba, then he's charging you for the keba based on the weight. So then when you sell it off, you can go back to him and you have recourse to him because he shouldn't have sold away the mitzvah that he had with his possessions. And therefore you can get the money refunded to you for that keba. So now, the same thing over here by Arishita Gaze. When he sells off all the animals to maintain some of the gaze for himself, he clearly is not selling the matnot kuna in that sale to you. For Rashi, there is a difficulty over here in the way he's explaining it, because there's a big difference between the case of matnot kuna and the case of gaze. But the case of the matnot kuna, he's already chayav in the matanot. The animal is shechted. He's selling him the innards, the intestines of the animal, and he hands him the intestines with the keba. Over there, you could argue that maybe he would not sell something he's chayav to give, or he won't sell something that he's obligated to give. But in our case of here, the Reshita Gaze has yet to shear the animals. There's no obligation. And Rashi says, "Gabei Reshita Gaze v'dayim peresh lo akol, if he sold everything, ani mocher lecha ein kan lekohen klum al zeh." And he can't go back to the seller because he sold everything. There's no other way about this. That's because there was no obligation yet. So he sells him everything. The kohen has no recourse against the seller because the seller was not chayav yet in Reshita Gaze. Delo grinam be gaze soncha. The time of the minita mishum delo zavne. So according to Rashi, despite the fact that you are yet to be chayav in gaze sono, a person doesn't sell away the mitzvah. If he sells everything, since he's yet to be chayav in the mitzvah, then you can't say to him, listen, you kept the mitzvah by you. That's not true. He sold everything. That means he sold the mitzvah and he's not chayav in the mitzvah yet. Therefore, the kohen has no recourse against him. On the other hand, when he sells a portion of it, we are going to make an assumption that he wants to take care of the mitzvah with his money. Therefore, he didn't sell away the mitzvah. And even though he's yet to be chayav, he's only chayav once he starts shearing. Nevertheless, we're assuming that he maintains it, similar to the case by the matanot where he was already chayav, and we say he wouldn't have sold it because he wants to do the mitzvah with his money, or people don't sell away a mitzvah from their possession. That's Rashi's reading. The obvious difficulty is exactly what we pointed out, which is the difference between the matzanot and the reshit hageiz is the fact that one, you're already chayav, one, you're not chayav. Tosafot says it, or expresses it the opposite way around. He expresses it from the buyer's perspective, and he's medayik it out of the ratio of the Mishnah. The ratio of the Mishnah says when you buy the intestines, then you give away the kebah to the kohen, you have no recourse. That's because when the buyer bought it, he knew that he was going to get a kebah that wasn't his, or he knew that the kebah wasn't being sold to him. When a buyer buys, he buys it ex de matanot kuna, because he knows that the matanot kuna are coming to him. So in the case where the mocher sells you all of the geiz, everything that he has, then in that case, the buyer knows the matanot kuna is coming out of this, whatever he sold him. That means whatever price he's naming, that price is for everything besides the matanot kuna, because he's aware of the fact that the matanot kuna must be subsumed in this item. The other hand, in the case by the mishkal, where he didn't intend to pay for the weight of a kebah, that means that when he was paying based on weight, and he assumed whatever weight was there was something that he was coming to him. He didn't expect the matnot kuna to be in there, and therefore he wouldn't have, his price included the matnot kuna. So then he could get a refund from you. And similarly by the geiz, when he bought all the shearings of the guy, but left some behind, then he assumes that I'm buying everything besides the matnot kuna, because I'm paying you for whatever it is. And I don't think the matnot kuna are in here, so therefore what I'm naming you the price is for what I'm getting. I'm not naming you a price for this, X the matnot kuna, because he thinks the matnot kuna are with the mocher. So that's the way Tosafot reads it, although Tosafot admits he does solve the problem of Rashi's issue, which is that there's a difference between being chayav by the matnot already, versus the gaze where you have yet to be chayav, so he solves that problem, because he's looking at it from the perspective of the buyer, not the seller. But he says that the language is a little bit problematic, because why is it the mocher speaking over here? Which is the next lines of the Gemara. The Gemara says over here, Hacha nami, matnot kohen lo mizamen inish. Just so too over here, by matnot kuna, people don't, according to Rashi, sell it. According to Bali Tosfot, they don't buy it. Hilkach, shier amocher, the mocher left something over amocher chayav. The mocher is chayav, da amarle lo keyach, matana de kohen gabei chi. He says to the mocher, the present or the item is by you. That works well for the Bali Tosafot, because the lokeach is speaking and saying that whatever the matnot kuna were, it's not in the price I was naming, because I assumed the matnot kuna with you. Rashi will say, the lokeach says, of course you didn't sell me the matnot kuna, because the mocher, you wouldn't give up that mitzvah, so of course it's by you. Lo shier, in the case where he didn't leave anything over, lokeach chayav, the purchaser is chayav. Damarle mocher, because the mocher speaks up and says, matanat kohen lo zavni lach. I didn't charge you for the matanot kuna. So now that's from the perspective of the mocher. For Tosafot, that's a lot harder to explain. He's saying it's lokeach's perspective. It's not about the mocher's perspective. Yet it's the mocher speaking over here telling him that I didn't charge you for the matanot kuna. I sold you. It's in there, but I didn't charge you for it. From Tosafot, it's about what the lokeach's thinking, not about what the mocher's thinking. That's why Tosafot says the language is difficult. For Rashi, this is exactly it. The mocher says that I didn't sell you the matnot kuna, because I would never sell the matnot kuna. So I'm only charging you for everything, but mocher doesn't usually sell it. And since he doesn't usually sell it, it's assumed to be there without being included in the price. And that's why you have no recourse against the mocher in that case, according to Rashi. So for Rashi, the language fits a little better, but you have the problem that you have then a disparity between matanot, where you're already chayav, and geiz, where you're not chayav. But Tosafot, it's from the perspective of the buyer, which eliminates the problem of the chiyuv versus no chiyuv, but it opens up the problem in the language of the Gemara, which Tosafot admits is not so smooth or easy to read in that last line of the Gemara. Okay, with that we complete Reshit HaGeiz, Hadran Halach, Reshit HaGeiz. Alright, now we're going to begin the last parak of the Masechta, which is the last of these sequence of Mishnayot that tell you a mitzvah, and then where and when do they apply. And so over here too, it's going to give us that format of the Mishnah, and the Gemara is going to discuss that format. Just before we start, the psukim that tell us in Parsha Ki Tetzei about Shiluach HaKein, Ki Kare Kan Tzibor Lefanecha Badarech B'chol Eitz O'al Haaretz Efruchim O'Beitzim Vayem Rovetzet Ala Efruchim O'al HaBeitzim Lo Tikach Haim Ala Banim. So you happen to come across a Kan Tzibor, a bird's nest, and in the bird's nest, you see over there, Ephrochim chicks, obeitzim, or eggs, ba'oim ovetzet alei fruchim alei beitzim, and the mother is hovering over them, lo tikeach chayim alabanim. Do not take the mother on the children. Shaleach tishalach adayim, but rather you must send away the mother, ve'tabanim tikachach, and then the youngsters, the chicks or the eggs you take for yourself, the mindi tablach ve'rachta yamim, in order that it be good for you and you have a long life. Now just from a grammatical standpoint, the Torah uses the word kan tzipor. That's because it's nismach. The nismach of the word kain is kan tzipor. But that means that whenever you use the word nest by itself, the word is kain and not kan. So because it's nismach, it's called kan tzipor. But it's called shiluach ha-kain because there it's not a nismach and the nest is kain. That's just a grammatical issue that many people confuse because of the word kan is used in the Torah, but it's only kan because it's a nismach. It's real, the underlying noun is a kain, and therefore here in the beginning of the parak, it's shiluach ha-kain. The reason for the mitzvah is discussed amongst the Rishonim. Many connect it to otoveh b'no, which is a similar mitzvah that's found by animals, and it has to do with the fact that you should have rachamim al the balei chayim. That's what the Rambam says in Mor Nebuchim. The Ramban does not like that explanation because he says if that was true, then first of all, many of these mitzvot, you shouldn't be able to shecht an animal. You shouldn't be able to do many other things. It was all about tzar balei chayim. But rather, the Ramban believes it has to do with the person themselves. It's to train the person to not be achzari. To train the person not to be someone who is cruel, but rather to be softer and have rachamim. So it's not about the birds in particular, or the saving of the birds in particular, but rather it's about the person who is interacting with the mitzvah. And that is a general view of the Ramban with regards to mitzvah, that the mitzvah are there to train people to be better people. So in order to inculcate within you certain midot or traits that Hashem wants and things that are good character traits, so we have mitzvot that refine you. And Kan Tzipor is one of those refinements. It's not about the birds. It's about the person that's doing it to teach them not to be cruel and to be nice. The Rambam views it as being something that is associated with the Balei Chaim, that one should have mercy or rachamim on Balei Chaim. Again, the Ramban doesn't like that because then there are many other things that you shouldn't be doing then if that's really what it's about. The Rambam, the Ramban's opinions are really the result of the two opinions in the Gemara of Brachot, where the Mishnah says that if someone gets up to daven for the Omud, and he says that Hashem should have rachamim on us, like you have al kan tzipor higiyu racham mecha, then we shatkin oto, we shut him down and we take him down. But there the Gemara has a machloket as to why you shut him down. Is it because matil kina bibriot, which means that you can make other animals jealous, which implies that the truth is it is because of rachamim, just we don't want you saying it because then it looks like Hashem favors the birds over other animals. But that means that the reason is rachamim, and that's what precipitated the Rambam's reading of what the reason for the mitzvah is. There's another opinion there which says that mitzvot are gzeirot, and they have nothing to do with rachamim. That's the view of the Ramban. Rachamim has nothing to do with the mitzvah, it's a gzeirah. But what's the gzeirah for? To refine the individual. So there is an aspect of rachamim, but it's not from the rachamim on the birds, it's about your rachamim and your ability to be empathetic. That's why we have such a mitzvah of Kiyur Kare Kan Tzipor. The Sefer Achinuch also mentions as the reason behind the mitzvah is that when it comes to Hashkacha, Hashem has Hashkacha Pratit over mankind, over individuals, humankind. When it comes to the Hashkacha over animals, He does not have Hashkacha over every individual animal, but rather on the species as a whole. And therefore these are demands where you don't, quote unquote, wipe out the species. That we don't want you causing things to be extinct. So therefore, we don't let you shecht otoveh b'no on the same day, because you want some sort of continuum to last. And same thing with the bird, the mother bird, and the chicks and the eggs. We want something to survive so that the species has a continuum. It's an interesting explanation only because otoveh b'no is only b'yom echad. The next day, you're able to do it, and the Kan Tzipor is the same thing. The next day, you can take the mother. So it seems to be not a really strong statement about that, but at least he mentions that as well. So that's as to the reason behind the mitzvah. The shiluach hakein noeg ba'aretz u'b'chutz la'aretz applies in Eretz Yisrael and outside of Eretz Yisrael. B'fnei abayit, shelo b'fnei abayit, whether the mikdash is extant or not. B'chulin avalo b'mukdashim, it applies to chulin and not mukdashim. Chomer b'kisui adam yishiluach hakein, now we're going to connect it to kisui adam, that has chumrot, is more stringent than shiluach hakein. Kisui adam noeg b'chayau both. Ksuvei Dam has application both to Chayot and Ofot. Bimizuman or Shein Bimizuman. Doesn't matter whether it's domesticated or wild. You're Chayav in Ksuvei Dam. Yishlach HaKain, Einenu Eg Ela Bof, Veinenu Eg Ela B'Shein Bimizuman. It only applies to birds. It only applies to Ki Karei Kan Sipor. When you happen upon it, if it's a domesticated, it's being brought up by you, it's not Chayav. Ezu Sheinu Mizuman. So then what's a Einu Mizuman? Kigon. For an example, Avazim, geese, Betarna Golim, or even chickens, Shekananuba Pardes. They set up shop. They are nesting out in the orchard. Now, the problem is that they were supposed to be in the house or in the barn, but they ran away, and they started to nest out in the orchards rather than in the place that you would have kept them as domesticated and raising them under your auspices. So they are still on your property, but they're not within your control or under your auspices because they ran away. But if they are nesting in the house, meaning in the barn or in the areas that are around the area where you are living, or these types of pigeons, which were these house pigeons or domesticated pigeons, then there is no shliach hakein over there because they're within the context or confines of your control, and that's not ki karei. And you're not just happening upon it. You're bringing them up. You're breeding them for your own use and your own purposes. And that's fine. Of tamei patur milishaleach. A non-kosher bird does not have a din of shiluach akein. That is because v'abanim tikach lach. You have to be able to take the eggs and use them. Lach means for you, not for your dog. It's a non-kosher bird. The eggs are non-kosher. You can't eat them. So that's be what you can take for yourself, not what you can take to give to your dog. Of tamei rofeitz al beitzei of tor. That would precipitate the next case. What happens if there's a non-kosher bird on kosher eggs? Now you don't have that statement that you can't take the eggs to throw to your dog. Here you can eat the eggs. They're kosher eggs. So if you have a non-kosher bird on kosher eggs, v'taor roveitza beitzei of tameh. Or vice versa, you have a kosher bird that is incubating non-kosher eggs. In both of those cases, patur min l'shaleach. You don't have to send it away. Each one of them for a different reason. The one about the non-kosher eggs is the same, whether it's a kosher bird on it or not a kosher bird on it, is that it's banim pikach lach. You have to be able to take them and utilize them for yourself to eat them. It can't be that you're giving it to your dog or something else to eat. That precludes anything that's a non-kosher egg. On the other hand, the word sipor, the Gemara is going to prove, always refers to a sipor tahor, and therefore there's a demand that the sipor itself be a tahor. But even if the sipor is tahor, there's still a requirement of a banim tikach lach. So the combination of those two make it that it has to be a mother that is tor and eggs that are torim. Although it does imply that if it was a kosher bird incubating another kosher bird's eggs, you would be chayav in shiluach hakein, even though it's not the quote-unquote biological mother. So now, kore zachar. It's not clear what this is. So not clear that even Rashi over here, you can see it says otameh, and then it says salikumar tohor. It's not even clear if it's a kosher bird or non-kosher bird. The reason that it's brought here is because zachar, the male, incubates the egg. So the question is, when a male is the incubator, what's the din? So if you say kore is a kosher bird, then the question is about this bird itself. If you say it's a non-kosher bird, it's just a paradigm. People were familiar with this bird, and they knew that the male is incubated. So it's just bringing it as an example. If the male is the incubating bird, then what is the din? Not about this bird in particular, but just this concept. What would be the din? The Korah is translated either as a partridge or something that's in the pheasant family that is something close to a large chicken. Whatever it is, it's just a case or a species where the males are incubating the eggs. Rabbi Eliezer Mechayev, Mechamim Potrin. So it's a machlok here whether the din of Kan Sipor applies when you have a male incubating the eggs. And now we go back and give a summary of all these Mishnayot that have this similar format as to the necessity for the format. We've noted almost every time that it's obvious that certain things apply. So, for instance, in this Mishnah, the fact that Shiluach HaKein applies both Ba'aretz and Bechutz Ba'aretz is not a Chiddush. It's not a mitzvah tuya Ba'aretz. There's no reason to believe that it wouldn't apply in Chutz Ba'aretz. So why is it mentioned here? We've said over and over again, it's because in one case it mattered, and they brought it down in all the other cases to keep a parallel structure. And as I always say, Mishnayot were made to be memorized. And when you're memorizing, having everything have the same structure makes memorization a lot easier. And therefore, you would keep the same pattern with just the nuanced changes between them, explaining the difference between the different cases. And so that's what the Gemara says here. Rabbi Avin, Rabbi Meisha, Chad Amar, Koecha that's not ba'aretz u b'chutzlaretz shelo d'tzorech. Anytime these Mishnayot said aretz and chutzlaretz, it was unnecessary. Levad mereshit hageiz. With the exception of reshit hageiz, where it was necessary to tell you that it applies ba'aretz u b'chutzlaretz, v'fuke midirabi Eli, to undermine or to exclude the position of Rabbi Eli, damar reshit hageiz enoheg ela ba'aretz. That reshit hageiz only applies in Eretz Yisrael. Both Rashi and the Baal HaTosafot supposed to say here what they said in the previous parak, which is that they believe that Rabbi Eli's din is not only about reshit hageiz, it's also about matanot. It's also about the zroa lechayayim and kebah that only applies ba'aretz and not b'chutzlaretz. That means that the Mishnah that said that matanot apply ba'aretz and b'chutzlaretz is also against Rabbi Eli. So then, why does the Gemara only mention this one? They say it means muadin. That's true also. Whatever the Mishnah said it, it was to undermine or to contradict that position of Rabbi Eli. That's true by matanot, it's true by reshit hageiz. Rashi says the reason it mentioned it by reshit hageiz, because that's the primary statement of Rabbi Eli. That's where we have a statement about it being applicable in Eretz Yisrael and Chutz La'aretz. And then from there, we learn it over to matanot. So Rashi and the Baal HaTosafot say that it would equally be true of matanot as well. Then the Ramban, the Rambam, all of those that disagree and say that Rabbi Eli's din is only about reshit hageiz, not about matanot, then it makes sense why the Gemara says only reshit hageiz is the only one where it matters. That's the only place where Rabbi Eli said his din. Chadamar, and the other one says, it's not that they're arguing. They're just giving these principles. Koheichad, it's not bifnei abayit, mishalo bifnei abayit. Every Mishnah where it says whether the Mikdash is extant or not, shalo letzorech. That was unnecessary. Levad meotoveh beno. With the exception of otoveh beno, where you needed it. Because, salkadat chamina, ho ubinyano de kodoshim k'tiv. Since the din of otoveh beno is found in the psukim that are dealing in Parshat Emor about kodoshim, you would have thought, because of the context, mizman ikah kodoshim ninhog, that when there are kodoshim that are being brought in the mikdash, then the din of otov ved beno would be applicable. Bizman deleka kodoshim lo ninhog. At a time when there are no kodoshim, then you would not have that din. Kamash malan, that's not true, and otov ved beno applies ben bifnei abayit, ben shilo bifnei abayit. We had that same question by otov ved beno by muktashim as well. Applies bechulin ubimuktashim, as what Gemara said over there. Hifsika inyan, to tell you that it is independent of that which is around it, and it is not dependent on kodoshim. It has application even by chulin. But then you would have said maybe there's some residual of that fact that is found in that context that still only applies when kodoshim are applicable. To that, the Gemara says that that's not the case, and when we say it applies in chulin, it's going to apply even outside the world of kodoshim. That's why I have to tell you that it applies ben bifnei abayit, ben shelo bifnei abayit. Everything else, it wasn't relevant to tell you that because there's no direct correlation or connection to kodoshim that would have given you the impression that it should only apply when the mikdash is extant. Now the Gemara says v'tarvayu amre, and they both say kol heichad detnan bechulin u'mikdashim, everywhere where it says bechulin u'bimukdashim, where it means that it applies to both of them letzorech. It was necessary, levad me gidan asher, with the exception of gidan asher. Now, as Tosafot points out, there are only two cases of this. The only two cases where it applies both by chulin and muktashim is the case of oto ved beno, and the case of gidan asher. So the Gemara could have formulated it just the opposite way around as well. Over here, the Gemara formulated it and says, everywhere it says chulin and muktashim, it's necessary, levad me gidan asher. Well, it's only necessary in oto ved beno, because that's the only place that it says it. So it's necessary by Otov Ebeno, but in Kiddush it's not necessary. You could have written it the other way around. You could have said every time it says Chulin Mikdashim, it's not necessary, with the exception of Otov Ebeno. Because you would have gotten the same conclusion. It's only between Otov Ebeno and Kiddush where both Chulin and Mikdashim are relevant. So Baal HaTosafot says either way you could have explained it that way, but because of the continuation of the Gemara, it favored expressing it in this manner. Which is, Koheicha does not Mechulim Mikdashim, it's the Tzorek, which is Otov Ebeno. There you would have Avamin, it only applies by Kodoshim, and then sure, Hifstika Inyan, to tell you that it even applies by Chulin as well. Then when you establish it's in Chulin, maybe it shouldn't apply to Mukdashim. Then we said the Vav is Chayder Arve, it connects them, and therefore it applies by both of them. But that's definitely a Chiddush by Otov Ebeno. By Gidan Asher, Pshita, Mishum Deikdash, Pakole Yisur Gidan Asher, Mine, Why would you think just because you're a makdish an animal, the issue of gidin asher should suddenly dissipate or disappear? If there's any problem with gidin asher, then why would you all of a sudden assume just because you're a makdish that it disappears? And that's why it's unnecessary over there. Where it says, v'lavu kimna v'vladot kodoshim. Didn't the Gemara in the end say, the reason the Mishnah mentions b'kulinu mukdashim is to tell you that it's applicable by mukdashim. You ask the question, what do you need that for? Because all mukdashim have a problem of getting a shift first, then why should the hekdesh cause it to dissipate? The Gemara over there answered, bladot kodoshim. The case where it's an offspring of kodoshim. Something that's hekdesh became pregnant, and now they have an offspring. In that situation, either they get in a shift is after the Kodesh or simultaneous with the Kodesh, depending on when you think the animal becomes Kodesh, whether it's when it's conceived or when it's born. In that case, either the Kodeshim happens simultaneously or they precede the Gidah Nasheh. And for that reason, they mentioned it because there is a case where Kodeshim could precede the Gidah Nasheh. My time Ukimna, La Mishum the Kashaklach, Lo Litne. Well, why did the Gemara do that? Gemara did that because they had a problem. Why did they write it in the Mishnah? So I'm telling you, Mikara Nami Lo Titzalach. You don't even need the question to start with. I did the Tana Letzorech, Tamina Letzalotz Letzorech. The fact is, the Gemara gave that answer because it was bothered by what was said in the Mishnah by Gidin Asher. But the truth is, you don't need to be bothered by it because the only reason it wrote it there is because it needed it by Oto Ved Bino. So in the end, what he's saying is, Enoch Nami, what you said in the Gemara is true. But it was unnecessary to even give that answer because you don't need the question in the first place. You gave the answer because you had a question. All I'm telling you is the question doesn't even get off the ground because these Mishnayot include things that are unnecessary. And in Ochanami, it's unnecessary, but it's just giving you a parallel to the structure in the case where it is necessary, and that's the case of Oto Ved Mino. And so that's why Tosfot says the Gemara framed it this way, Koyeka Tanan B'chulin Mukdashim Letzorach, the Vad Gidin Asher, is because they're going to discuss Gidin Asher. Even though they're going to express it in the opposite manner, but since they're going to discuss Gidin Asher, they made the Gidin Asher Shalom Tzorech in order to go through what the Gemara does over here. The Chulin of Alo Mekdashim, by Shiluach HaKain, it applies to Chulin, it does not apply to Kodoshim. Amaylo, why doesn't it apply by Kodoshim? Damakrash, Shaleach Tishalach Etaim, send away the mother bird. That's only true of someone where the mitzvah is to send it away. Yatzazeh, Shiata Mitzuveh L'Shalcho. That's not true in the case where it's Hekdesh. You don't have a mitzvah to send away, rather to bring it to the treasurer of Hekdesh. If you see Hekdesh over there, your job is not to chase it away, shoo it away. Point is, it belongs to Hekdesh. You're trying to get it to Hekdesh, not trying to chase it away from Hekdesh. Amar Ravina, Hilkach, Uf Tohor, Sharaget Nefesh. If you have a kosher bird that killed someone, Patur Milishloach. There's no din of Shiluach HaKein. Now, first of all, the bird killing an individual goes to the din that if an animal kills an individual, the animal is subject to skila, it has to be put to death. There's a Mishnah in Brachot, testimony that is matching up the Mishnah in Ediot. There was a case in Yerushalayim where they stoned the Tarnagol for killing a child. So you have this very aggressive chicken, or you have these very big turkeys or roosters that are a little bit wilder, a little more forceful, and we're dealing with a little kid or a very small child, it's possible that they could have killed someone. Given that, they would be subject to a death penalty. In this case, then, your patur milishloach, my taima, for the same reason, damarkar, shaleach tishalach etayim. You have to send it away. Over here, you're not supposed to send it away. You have to rather, ela avil to beit din. You have to bring it to beit din in order to be stoned, in order to be killed. Hey, chidomi, what's the case here? If it's a situation in which the verdict has already been rendered, bar katolohu, it's subject to a death penalty. They were sentenced it and killed it on the spot. There's no din of looking for a zchut for the individual. We're not talking about a capital punishment for an individual where you, after you have the verdict, you still wait, you try to tarry, you try to delay because you want, maybe someone will come up with a zchut that will exonerate the individual or get him out of the problem. Here you're dealing with an animal. The animal killed, then they come to a verdict, then they put it to death, and that's it. There's nothing to discuss. What's this animal doing? Running away. Ella deloka mardine. It must be a case where there's no verdict. Well, if there's no verdict yet, then why do you have the obligation to bring it to beit din? The answer is, ubayile atuile beit dino. There is still an obligation upon you to bring it to beit din. That you should wipe out the bad and evil amongst you, Rashi says, a mitzvah called a pogeya b'chayavei mita. Someone who bumps into a chayav mita, that's both a human being and an animal. Havian the beitin is a mitzvah to bring them to beitin, de la ba'er rishayim Israel. To eliminate the evil things by the animals or evil people from amongst B'nai Israel. There's a mitzvah of Yata Rami Kibrecha. Now that doesn't mean you should be a vigilante and you should take matters into your own hands. But it does mean that you should ensure that justice prevails over here. And if you find something like that, you should bring them to Beit Din. And similar over here, an animal that is subject to what possibly could be a death penalty for killing someone, then you bring them to Beit Din. You gotta be Yatam Yarami Kibrecha. So that's the obligation of the individual to bring it to Beit Din. So now, the way that we have the Gerson explanation in our Gemara, the reason that there's no din of Shiluach HaKein here is because you can't send away the mother bird. You have an obligation to do something else with it. The case of Ekdesh, to bring it to the Gizbar, and in the case of the bird that killed, to bring it to the Beit Din. So therefore, when you do Shaleach to Shalach, you're then actually abrogating another obligation that you have, and therefore you don't have permission to do Shaleach to Shalach. There are two issues over here. The first of which is, what is the Gemara's Havamin over here in terms of Kodoshim? Gemara says, Hamaylo, why can't you send away the bird by Kodoshim? The Ramban over here points out that the question seems somewhat strange, because what's the Havamin of the Gemara over here that Shiluach HaKein should apply by Kodoshim? But we're going to demand that someone takes a bird of Kodoshim and sends it away? Why would we ever ask that of an individual? First of all, it's a bird of Hekdesh. Second of all, what is his responsibility vis-a-vis this bird of Hekdesh? So the Ramban says that the Havamina is that the Shiluach HaKein, or the sending away of the mother, has two implications. One is that you send away the mother, that's the mitzvah. The other implications are that you're allowed to take the banim. So the Havamina of the Gemara is that yes, by Muktashim it would apply, not that you would have to send away the mother, because you can't send away the mother, it's Hekdesh, but rather, you would have to leave the mother, and since you have to leave the mother, you can't take the chicks or the eggs. And that would be the din. Along comes the Mishnah to say, no, lo b'muktashim means it doesn't have application by muktashim at all. And that means that even if you don't send away the mother, you still have a right to take the Efrochim of Beitzim, because there's no mitzvah of Shiluach HaKein by Kodoshim. So that's the Chiddush over here. That's what the Gemara is after. It's to determine that muktashim has no application in Shiluach HaKein at all, rather than to tell you that you can't send away the mother bird. That we would have known irrespective of what the Mishnah says. But rather, what it's telling you is the implications of that. Had it been without the Mishnah and without the reasoning that we have here, then the implications would be that since you can't send away the mother, you can't eat the chicks or the eggs. But now that it tells you, the Mishnah, that it doesn't apply to Muktashim, and the reason being, the Torah would not tell you to send it away when you have to bring it to the Gizbar, now there's no din of Shiluach HaKein here at all, and the Efrochim and the Beitzim are now Mutarim, the Gamrei. The other thing is, Tosafot over here quotes a Rashi that we do not have. He says, Rashi brings the reason as to why you can't take these birds is, the Torah does not say send them away to get you into trouble. That is a logic or an explanation the Gemara gives with regards to the birds of the Mitzora. When it comes to the birds of the Mitzora, it says that you have to shoo away, you have to throw away one of the birds. The Gemara over there says that it can't be that the one that you send away is a surbahana, because the Torah wouldn't tell you to send it away, so that someone's going to get into trouble with this when they find it somewhere else, because they're going to be neh-neh from isurana. For that reason, it must be that the bird you send away has no isurana that's associated with it. So Rashi says the same thing over here. The Torah can't be telling you, shaleach tishalach da'im, when now if the aim goes off, it's something that is a surbahana, it belongs to Hekdesh. And you're shooing it away, and someone else is going to capture it. So Tosfo quotes that Rashi, and he says, Vikasha. He says, first of all, Chadad Lishno Lo Mashach. If you read the text, it doesn't sound anything like that. That's number one. Vod, in the case where the verdict is rendered, there's an Isarana. But the Gemara in the end says that the case here is a case where the verdict wasn't rendered. And therefore there's no Isarana associated with the bird. So what Takalai is there by shooing away a bird that is supposed to be brought to Beit Din? And therefore Tosfo thinks that, Niri the Pashti the Kro Dorish. The Gemara is just talking about the Pashut Pshat in the Pasuk, the Mashim and the Mideh Shiachol Shokol Mishtai. Pasuk is talking about things that you can shoo away. Things that you can send away. Things you can't send away don't have that in. Alright, we're going to stop here on the top of Kuf Lamed Aleph, three lines down.